This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
This is just the beginning. The vote of the board does not at all signify the end. It just signifies the beginning of our work. We are excited, we are ready, and we are unstoppable.
The National Education Association Board has just blocked a grassroots push to remove the Anti-Defamation League from classrooms. Rank-and-file educators are fighting back.
And we're calling out our governments here. We're saying enough's enough. Workers, transport workers in particular, must have the right to know what they're moving. Since the Gulf War in 2003, those manifests have been removed from dockers, been removed from transport workers, and that's unacceptable.
We hear from Paul Keating of the Maritime Union of Australia about dock workers taking action to block military and economic aid to Israel to protest the Gaza genocide.
You know, the attack that began with Palestine activists is now being used to spread terror throughout communities of color all over the country.
Defense attorney Mark Kleiman on defending student protesters and migrant workers and families targeted for U.S. government repression. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. The board of the National Education Association recently subverted union democracy by refusing to implement a rank-and-file decision to drop the Anti-Defamation League from its classrooms. Marcy Winograd, coordinator of Code Pink's Drop the ADL campaign, spoke with union organizer Mary Najimi about the leadership's betrayal of the base, as well as the power of the rank-and-file to unmask the ADL.
I'm Marcy Winograd. With me today is Mary Najimi. She is the former president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association, a co-founder of Massachusetts Rank and File for Palestine, and a co-founder of the Caucus Educators for Palestine and the National Education Association, the largest teachers union and the largest union in the country with 3 million members. So welcome, Mary.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here and talk about this monumental accomplishment that we had inside of the NEA.
Exactly. So just to sum up, the NEA rank and file, we have about 7,000 delegates in that union, voted for a motion that said the NEA will not partner with the Anti-Defamation League for curriculum or professional development, given its history of surveillance and opposition to groups fighting for social justice and to end racism. And yet, on the heels of that, we hear that the president of the union, Becky Pringle, the executive committee, the 9 members, and the entire board, which has over 100 people, voted to not implement that. So I'm wondering how you see that, you know, what your response is, and just what your overall response is to the excitement that this campaign has generated.
Right. You know, it's certainly the vote of the board to reverse the democratically made decision. The vote of the representative assembly has infuriated, you know, the overwhelming number of people who actually voted in favor of this new business item. And within that, however, the leadership did learn some important things. If you look at President Pringle's statement, she actually shows that what she learned was that the ADL is an organization that suppresses speech and attacks Palestinians and other BIPOC and anti-Zionist Jewish members. And she acknowledged that in her statement by calling on the ADL to support free speech. She strongly condemned them and used words like their aberrant and unacceptable attacks on our members. But the leadership still hasn't fully understood what the manifestations of anti-Palestinian racism are. And they're not able to see the ADL's actions through that lens. But you know what? What matters more, Marcy, is the passage in the first place of this new business item, because it represents a sea change in people's understanding of who the Palestinians are and what their struggle is. It shows that the rank and file of the NEA, and actually the rank and file of many of the state affiliates, is calling for a new position with inside the NEA, supporting Palestinian rights, opposing the normalization of support for Israel in general, and also in K-12 education. And it has broken the facade of the ADL, and we've exposed the harm that ADL is causing, and there's no going back from there. So that's the real victory.
So let's talk about that. You say the harm of the ADL. I've closely looked at their lesson plans, at their curriculum, which includes A World of Difference, No Place for Hate, Echoes and Reflections. And now in California is officially part of a state-sanctioned teachers collaborative to provide professional development for teachers. So it's important that we look very closely at what they are saying. And here's what they're saying. In Echoes and Reflections, the ADL, Anti-Defamation League, has a whole unit on contemporary anti-Semitism, which they clearly equate with criticism of Israel, to silence dissent. And in fact, they have a whole article on how peace activists are aligned with extremists. And we know that they have a history of suing school districts and colleges, and they boast about that. And they include on their website articles attacking Jewish Voice for Peace, one of the fastest growing Jewish organizations, an anti-Zionist organization of which I am a member. So it's troubling to think that a teachers union would be promoting attacks on a Jewish organization, promoting attacks on peace activists, or rubber stamping propaganda to shield Israel during a genocide.
Right, right. And this is one of the reasons why we, you know, Educators for Palestine has actually been highly successful in the last couple of years. It was because Educators for Palestine that the NEA finally came out and called for a ceasefire with the whole National Labor Network, that they called for an arms embargo. We actually last year on the floor of this representative assembly, which is like a giant town hall meeting, passed a new business item that they would teach about the Nakba. So the ADL, in addition to all of the problematic things that you just listed about the curriculum, has several other problematic elements to it. And it's just our job to continue to educate the NEA and rank and file members. So they consistently commit acts of anti-Palestinian racism by dehumanizing Palestinian people, pushing to erase and censor the Palestinian narratives like you just described, falsely conflating the criticism of Zionism and the state of Israel with anti-Semitism. But there's also more than that. They have a long and sordid history of surveilling the Palestinian Liberation Movement, the South African anti-apartheid movement of the 80s and 90s, Zionist Jews who participated in either or both. A third thing, they sponsor municipal police to take trips to Israel to learn anti-terrorism policing tactics. And we saw that manifest for the first time in Ferguson. And now we see it pervasive in how police Black and Brown communities. Fourth, their racist attacks extend beyond the Palestinian and Jewish community. They attack Black, Indigenous, and queer people, mostly for intersectional organizing. And finally, they're just not a reliable source for civil rights data or anti-Semitism data. There are actually Jewish scholars and Jewish news sources have pointed out their reliance on vague reports, lack of verification, and then the conflation of these weighty anti-Semitic issues that are real with these sort of trivial incidences or incidences that are about the criticism of Israel. So it's for all of those reasons, not just the curriculum, that we're forcing this into the light and wanting NEA to take a stand.
Mary, as coordinator of the Drop the ADL campaign at Code Pink, I just am so grateful to you and to the other rank and file activists who have campaigned to drop the ADL and regardless of what anti-democratic moves are made by the board or the president of this 3 million member union, the rank and file knows what's happening. I mean, you can't unsee what you have seen. And we have seen the ADL, initially at least, defend the Trump administration's arrest of Mahmoud Khalil, the Palestinian leader at Columbia. We have seen the ADL on television compare keffiyehs, a symbol of Palestinian liberation, a scarf that Palestinian farmers wore with swastikas. This is outrageous. We should not be promoting the ADL in our schools. And so my message to those who are listening, if you are involved in schools, if you're a parent, if you're a teacher, an educator, a taxpayer, make your views known. If you feel compelled to communicate with your local school district, that they should not be promoting the ADL, partnering with any of their curriculum or professional development. Now, Mary, let's talk for a minute. And I also want to congratulate you on passing that Nakba resolution. Some people may not know the Nakba is the Arabic term for catastrophe of the 1947-48 ethnic cleansing of Palestine, when Zionist terrorists were burning villages to the ground, burning olive groves, erasing Palestinian history, and imposing a Jewish state, an ethno-nationalist state on historic Palestine, expelling, 750,000 to 1 million Palestinians never allowed to return. They may not know that history, but you passed that resolution. So that's going to be fascinating to see teachers teach about the Nakba, which I absolutely applaud. I mean, I think we have to talk about the Holocaust, the murder of 6 million Jews, 11 million people total during the Nazis' Third Reich. But we also need to talk about the Nakba. So your thoughts about how that might unfold?
Yeah, I think we're in a new moment where we have to recognize that a genocide takes many different forms. It has unfolded over many centuries throughout history. And we can no longer exceptionalize one over any other, right? We have to, if we always say, the Palestinian Solidarity Movement always says, the struggle for Palestinian liberation is not a zero-sum game. Right now, the state of Israel has made it a zero-sum game that Israelis have to win at the expense of Palestinians. But what Palestinians and all of us in solidarity with them, including a large swath of Jewish people around the country and the world, is that our liberation is inextricably linked to each other, right? And so this is also part of the work of liberated ethnic studies, which the ADL also attacks, because liberated ethnic studies compels people to look at systems and structures of oppression, occupation, colonization, and the ADL does not want Israel to be lumped in with that. So our job as educators is to continue to educate ourselves, each other, on how to teach in the context of a racial solidarity framework, and recognizing, you know, I don't know what the future curriculum would be, but my hope is we can look at what are the standards of genocide, the agreed upon international standards of genocide, and how do we help children look at what's happening in Palestine and critique what's happening to the Palestinians in Gaza, what Israel is imposing against those 10 criteria. It's not our job to tell them how to think. It's our job to teach them how to analyze events historically, today, against standards and criteria that the world has set.
Agreed. And it's our job, I think, to empower students, as I know many of us do, by sharing how resistance movements have succeeded in the past. I know that the ADL does not want people to know about that, right? They might say, okay, it's fine to learn about the civil rights movement as long as you don't talk about Black Lives Matter support for Palestinian liberation. Mary, let's talk a minute about the organizing that led up to this momentous rank and file vote not to partner with the Anti-Defamation League. You talked about Educators for Palestine, the caucus within the NEA. What else was involved?
Yeah, it started about 7 years ago. It's been a long journey, and it's been a hard journey. About eight years ago at the Representative Assembly, there was one Arab American NEA member who looked around and said, so structured by the constitution and bylaws of the NEA, they recognize four ethnic groups. And they're the traditional ethnic groups from long ago. Black, Asian Pacific Islander, Indigenous, and Latino. We now call Latinx. He was getting frustrated that there was no recognition of the ethnic group of Arabs. So he reached out and he found me, a handful of other Arabs, some who are Palestinian, a couple of anti-Zionist Jews, and we formed actually an informal Arab American caucus. And that's when we started moving new business items just to educate, not even take positions, just to educate on the history of Palestine. And the debates on the floor were so racist, it caused so much harm. And we lost very badly. But we did what union organizers do. Over the 7 years, we just kept having one-on-one conversations with rank and file members. And we slowly started to change people's minds. We slowly just made ourselves visible and we humanized Palestinians and Arabs. Now, the genocide live streaming into our devices 2 years ago added to what people fundamentally understood about the history of the region and who Palestinians were, because they were telling their own stories suddenly in their own words. Last year, we passed a bylaw amendment to say that now one of the officially recognized ethnic groups will be Arab Americans, actually will be the MENA designation, Middle East, North Africa, because it is now part of the census. That felt like another turning point. This is a social justice, racial justice union. And when we passed that, people were beginning to see that part of social and racial justice means taking the Arab community from the margins and putting them into the center. We then decided to split off last year and form a second caucus, Educators for Palestine, because there were so many more people who were not Arab that wanted to be part of the struggle. That's when we won the new business item to educate about the Nakba. And honestly, the 3 or 4 years before that, we started losing less badly. And that was a victory, right? But what really did it in the last 2 years were the number of one-on-one conversations that we had. And in the mornings, every state delegation gets together to deliberate on the new business items that are going to be passed that day. We were able to raise the issues to be debated and deliberated on the floors of our state caucuses. And it was there that a lot of Educators for Palestine changed the minds of the body so that the body would go in taking positions of support. So it was the multiple paths that it took to get there. And unfortunately, it did take genocide for people to finally see this has been a story of injustice that has been invisible to us. And now we are no longer going to tolerate it. And we're going to fight and push the NEA to take better positions.
Well, thank you so much for your thoughtful organizing. And there's no one answer to this, right? It takes time, right. It takes effort, it takes a lot of conversations, like you said, not necessarily attacks, but reaching out, outreach. So in that spirit, what would you say to people who are listening, who want to support rank and file teachers in the National Education Association who voted for the motion not to partner with the Anti-Defamation League for curriculum or professional development? What would you say to them?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things that are really important. Go to the NEA Today Instagram page and post how you're feeling. Let the NEA know. In 24 hours, we had 7,000 signatures to the NEA when the vote passed to stay strong. It's time to let them know your frustration, your anger, your outrage, that they undid the will of the body. That's one thing you could do. The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee put out a fabulous, excoriating press release to their partner. The NEA is a partner with the ADC. So that's one. Those are a couple of things. The other thing that's really important, we only make change when we build the relationships one person at a time. So if you have children in the public schools, or if you just care about public education, start conversations with the educators in your district schools. They are often feeling isolated and intimidated because they have experienced the repression from the ADL and other organizations like it. When people know other people have their back, and when they know there's a solidarity movement, this is what will help them move through their fear and find the courage to act. So I think it's those two things. It's pressure up and relationships at the grassroots.
Absolutely. Solidarity forever. I am reminded of that when I read the ADL's celebration of this gut punch to the base of the National Education Association with the leadership, the board, the president, overturning, from my vantage point, not necessarily in alignment with the rules, the standing rules of the organization, overturning this motion not to partner with the ADL. I would say, look, we are a union movement, right? This is one chapter, one event. United Teachers of Los Angeles, the second largest teachers union in the country behind the New York City Teachers Union, voted last winter, I think it was, to not partner with the ADL. So this is a movement. This is gaining ground. And for those who are looking for alternative resources, I would start subscribing to Rethinking Schools. In fact, I think somebody that we know, could be me, will have an article with Alex Sanchez coming out soon on why Echoes and Reflections, the ADL's curriculum, does not reflect the thinking of progressives in this country and beyond who want to see international law upheld and an end to this genocide that Israel is perpetrating with U.S. weapons and financing in Gaza, in Palestine. So we have to carry on, and I so appreciate your leadership, your energy. Thank you, Mary Najimi, for joining us on this program to share the union's success stories and give us some guidance on how to go forward.
Yeah, well, it's been lovely to be here with you. This is just the beginning. The vote of the board does not at all signify the end. It just signifies the beginning of our work. We are excited, we are ready, and we're unstoppable.
You are. So thank you. Take care.
Thank you. You too.
That was union organizer Mary Najimi speaking to Marcy Winograd, coordinator of Code Pink's Drop the ADL campaign.
Peace and blessings to all. Race, color, creed, countries, lines, things like that shouldn't separate us. Part of mankind, be kind of man. Care for the children everywhere. No war, no war against Iran. Peace everywhere, love, yeah. No war against Iran. I believe love for all is the most high plan. No bombs, no missiles, no racist dog whistles. The world is God's house, try to keep the law with you. A child life is valuable, let's deal with raw issues. After we finish that, let's deal with more issues like understanding energy, connect with soul, money and politics, and greed shouldn't wreck us.
The killers chilling in villas while militants pillage villages. Is it just a pigment they didn't consider innocent? Villainous, insidious minions, really hideous. The city is clearly invidious when you think of it. Pilger did uncover the truth and they tried to hinder it. Diligent, the wretched of the earth, they were kin to him. Forget awards, we don't even get nominations. Liberate yourself from the weight of West intoxication. The pain of harbor burns like phosphorus rain on God. They say I'm rather like Sheikh Osama or Che Guevara, but Sheikh Osama was Gates, Carter, and Reagan's partner. So we don't rate Osama, neither do we rate Obama. When you measure life in wars, know you're getting older. Still marching on this quest, we will never falter. Clever soldier wising up to the death they soldier, like Hugo Chavez at the UN smelling sulfur.
No war against Iran, I believe love all is the most high plan. No bombs, no missiles, no racist dog whistles. The world is God's house, try to keep the law with you. A child life is valuable, let's deal with raw issues. After we finish that, let's deal with more issues like understanding energy, connect with soul, money and politics, and greed shouldn't wreck us all.
We are the children in the classroom you used to shush. We are the people on the plane getting accusing looks. Got you searching for a new button you could push. The moment Montada Razedi threw his shoes at Bush. We don't have a choice. A little child's last breath is the saddest noise. They call us.
That was Low Key. No War. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Polina Vasilyev. Working class anger about the genocide in Gaza is growing, particularly among longshore workers around the world. Paul Keating is a leader of the Sydney branch of the Maritime Union of Australia. He talked with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about dockers taking action to block military and economic aid to Israel.
It was exposed last week that certain components were air freighted directly from Australia to Israel. The manufacturing of components for the arms trade are very much part of the, you know, in Australia, very much part of the global industrial military complex of the West. We make components, we make arms of some nature, and they may be assembled in another country, but they're destined in some cases for Israel. And we're calling out our governments here. We're saying enough's enough. Workers, transport workers in particular, must have the right to know what they're moving. Since the Gulf War in 2003, those manifests have been removed from dockers, been removed from transport workers. And that's unacceptable. It's unacceptable when we see every day the genocide and the brutality that continues to increase in Gaza, perpetrated by Netanyahu and his government, a war criminal, given the orders for his Israeli Defense Force to carry out this murder. It's unacceptable that governments are quiet or silent. And it's unacceptable that governments, like here in Australia, where that at state and federal levels, state in particular, laws are being enacted by governments that criminalise the right to protest, the right to legitimate protest against bad governments, against war, against genocide. And all this is distorted in relation to the criticism of Israel as somehow that's anti-Semitic. We criticise, and there's greater scrutiny on the Israeli lobby, very much a powerful force within Australia and other Western countries like the US, dictating policy. And quite frankly, in some cases, the hubris is breathtaking. But we're fighting these laws here in Australia where that protest, legitimate protest at arms manufacturing facilities against these arms that are destined for Israel to kill innocent people. The right to protest in our streets is being taken away from us. And that will continue. I'd say this to all our communities and a message to dockers the world over. Our unity is in struggle. Our great tool, our greatest weapon, our greatest defence is solidarity. And it's the solidarity in defending the values that we hold dear, that everyone is equal, that everyone deserves to live in peace, and for the Palestinian people, that they deserve a right to nationhood and statehood.
And of course, the ILWU on the West Coast has been involved in many of these struggles of internationalism, of solidarity, supporting the Liverpool dockers with the Neptune Jade, supporting the ILA dockers by sending a delegation and building international support, and of course, by supporting a labor community boycott of the Zim shipping line. Yeah. So the Zims are no longer going to West Coast ports. The role of the United States government, as you know, is united with the Zionist government, with the Israeli government, which is committing war crimes, genocide, and as is in Australia, trying to criminalize opposition to the genocide with witch hunts of educators, with retaliation against dockers. In fact, even Hegelsson, Erik Hegelsson in Sweden, has been fired for the labor boycott that the Swedish dockers did of military cargo to Israel. How do you see this international struggle to stop the war by labor taking place? Because there has been retaliation, as I just said, against dockers who do take action. And yet the workers, the dockers, the transport workers have the power to shut down the war by shutting off the military cargo and the economic support to Israel.
I'll say this is a public interview. Dockers will do what dockers have always done. You said, Steve, around the Zim shipping lines. It's, I don't know, it's 15, 16 months ago. We had a number of the first protests in the ports were in Port Botany in Sydney. And it was directed at Zim shipping. Those vessels were taken off the coast, and we don't have them anymore. But they integrated their service with MSC. So although that the vessels were removed, and I think that was because of the direct community action and dockers, the MUA, backing in our communities and exposing the failure of the state, but calling out the brutality and the murder that was unfolded in Gaza. Dockers, there wasn't a resolution that specifically outlined a directive, but there was a discussion and a collective view, I can tell you that, with the hundreds that attended, that we will support and defend dockers the world over where that they take action or in solidarity with the Palestinian people and against genocide. I've made it very clear on many rallies where I've spoken, and I've called out the shipping industry. The Maersks of this world have made it very clear that they are responsible for the movement of arms, and that's unacceptable. And they'll be called out for it. If they don't want protest, if the shipping industry do not want, or governments do not want protest or the stoppage of goods, arms, they have to declare that, you know, arms embargoes on Israel. The shipping lines need to come out and say, we will not move arms destined for Israel. And until that time, there's going to be an ongoing, continued mobilizing of this global people's movement. And dockers are working class people, a part of it. And working class people are being guided by their conscience. We have a right when it comes to genocide. All workers have a right. It doesn't matter what laws are in place. I'm going to say this. I say this to my members, and I say it to workers across the world and dockers. There is no laws that can be put in place that makes it acceptable for genocide. We can remove our labour. We can remove our labour, and we can stop it. If governments aren't going to do it, we need to do it. The working class need to be vigilant. We need to fight against this terror because it is not much, it's not even a leap from rights, civil rights, workers' rights being removed by law to the next stage. And the next stage, clearly history tells us, we certainly don't want to go back to those days that we've seen in Europe. But we're here. This is the thing, we're here. I think the material conditions of the rise of this, you know, fascism or fascist tendencies by these popular actors like Trump, we will see a more radical view of the working class as they rip away the foundations of systems, conditions that give everybody the dignity of life. As those things are ripped away and the ruling class take more, the diminution of, you know, universal health or education or, you know, the security of housing or decent jobs, the removal of the right to work, civil rights, laws enshrined, so that racism doesn't get a foothold. We'll see a more radical working class. We see with neoliberalism, it's destroying the planet. It's unsustainable. Capitalism's unsustainable. and the science is there. The ruling class can—they control, you know, the nature of communication globally. They condition the masses, but what they can't condition is that when the working class are in struggle, that our rights removed, and that we see our neighbour subjected to some horror because of the colour of their skin or the fact that they hold a union card or belong to the Socialist Party or Communist Party or a Progressive Party or a part of, you know, this global movement of environmental activists and climate activists, you know. The material conditions start changing for the working class. Like what we see with this genocide in Gaza, the West doesn't. The Western powers, our politicians, our leaders, have failed us. And we see this mass movement of people. Doesn't matter what the Fox News regurgitates or spews out. And here in Australia, the Murdoch Press, they're... namesake Sky News with this, you know, fanatic right-wing propaganda. We're all seeing real-time the brutality unfold in Gaza, the murder, the daily killings of children and women and civilians and doctors and nurses and ambulance workers and journalists and those brave people that work for these non-government organizations that are trying to make a difference. And we see the hypocrisy in the West. You know, there's no universal Western values. If we close our mind to this that's going on, the same is happening with the rise of these ultra-nationalist platforms, these fascist agendas. You know, the truth is the working class have more in common with each other. You and I have more in common with a railway worker in Pakistan or a factory worker in China than any rich person in Australia or the US or billionaire. They are completely removed. They're not from our class. So I think in material terms, the material dialectic is coming together with forces that we'll see, I think, a radicalising, a mobilising of the working class. And it only takes a spark. The working class reject war. We fight for peace. It was the peace movement that was global from people like yourself and myself and working class communities. There's no such thing as a middle class. It's a construct of the ruling class. I want to make that point. There's the ruling class and then there's the working classes. And we need to unite. We need to unite in defense of the dignity of human life and the dignity for all and against the hate of the politics that sweeps the West in particular.
That was Maritime Union of Australia's Sydney chair, Paul Keating, talking about the growing movement of dockers around the world to block military and economic cargo to Israel. He was interviewed by Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
When I was a young man, I carried a pack and I lived the free life of a rover. From the Murray's Green Basin to the dusty outback, I was my Matilda all over. Then in 1915, the country said, son, there's no time for roving, there's work to be done. And they gave me a tin hat and they gave me a gun, and they marched me away to the war. And the band played Waltzing Matilda as the ships pulled away from the quay. Amidst all the cheers, the flag waving and tears, we sailed off for Gallipoli. How well I remember that terrible day when our blood stained the sand and the water, and how in that hell they called Suvla Bay we were butchered like lambs at the slaughter. Johnny Turk, he was ready, he'd primed himself well, showering us with bullets, then he rained us with shell, and in 10 seconds flat he'd blown us to hell. He nearly blew us back home to Australia. The band played Waltzing Matilda as we stopped to bury the slain. We buried ours and the Turks buried theirs. Then we started all over again. Those that were left, we tried to survive.
That was the Bushwhackers, and the band played Waltzing Matilda. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Next, we'll hear the second half of an interview with Los Angeles defense attorney Mark Kleiman by Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke. They discuss the civil liberties of U.S. college students, migrant workers, and their families, who are all targets of government repression by multiple federal agencies, including the U.S. military. A correction of part one of the interview that aired last week. It was Texas v. Johnson, 1989, where the Supreme Court agreed that flag burning was a constitutionally protected act of symbolic speech and thus speech protected by the First Amendment.
How have the protests of, around Palestine, how do they relate to the defense of immigrants in this country, that this renewed campaign that, you know, that Trump promised and is now delivering on and seems now to have just been grossly overfunded in this big, beautiful monstrosity of a omnibus budget bill? How are these protests related to the defense of immigrants and clearly the Trump's ICE and Homeland Security raids are intending to intimidate and strong-arm people into fear and leaving the streets, as well as also imparting the notion that an entire class of people is criminalized? How are they related, the defense of Palestinian protesters and the defense of immigrants?
The attack on Palestinian protesters is really the point of the spear, if you will, of the right wing. If you look historically for a moment and look at the area in this country in the late 1940s and early 1950s, the Red Scare was not just about suppressing communists, although that was bad enough. It was used to also attack and suppress anybody who had stood up for racial equality, for peace, for women's rights, for militant labor organizations, whether or not they were communists. It didn't matter. The biggest and loudest voices for the Red Scare were all the people who wanted to use that, whip up that hysteria to attack women, people of color, gays, especially gay and queer people in government. What we're seeing now is very much the same thing. What began with, you know, sweeping Palestinian activists and academics off the street in a couple of very public raids has now spread to picking up people at car washes, grabbing people from schools, stealing people away from courthouses where they're required to appear.
The Washington Post today says that 63% of all immigrants that that have been arrested so far have no criminal record at all, none whatsoever. And I imagine those that do, they're including misdemeanors like traffic or something else. In other words, yeah, the cartel criminals, they don't get caught up in these kinds of sweeps, I'm sure. They're catching, you know.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, or if they do, they'll get caught up incidentally. This is, you know, the attack that began with Palestine activists is now being used to spread terror throughout communities of color all over the country, where you have people missing doctor's appointments, keeping their kids home from school, unable to go to work, etc. What this is going to do ultimately, I think it's going to drive two political impulses. One is greater unity and respect for the Palestinian cause, because these are the people who got swept up first and targeted first. And now everybody else understands it as well. It also, frankly, creates some challenges for the movement, because, you know, the organizations working around Palestine and working to end the genocide now have to confront the question of how do we exist in a coalition with groups or people who have countenanced this horrible, unspeakable crime that has unfolded in Gaza? And how do we navigate that? So it's not without its political problems, but as repression always does, it generates its own enemies.
Can you comment on the recent SCOTUS decision on a birthright citizenship challenge? The decision that ignored the 14th Amendment touchstone, but instead told lower courts to limit their rulings to parties before them rather than to generalize their rulings to apply nationwide. In other words, these nationwide injunctions that federal district court judges have been levying that seems to have been knocked aside by SCOTUS, and they've been told, stay in your lane and decide only the case you have in front of you.
It's hard to keep a civil tongue in my head with this one.
Yeah.
Because during the Biden administration, every time the government rolled out, and even during the second Obama administration, every time the government rolled out an initiative that set some right-wingers' hair on fire, they'd go running to a hand-picked judge who would try to issue, lo and behold, a nationwide injunction and do the same thing. And what the Supreme Court has used is what we call the shadow docket. Cases normally take years to get to the Supreme Court, because you go through the district court, the court of appeal, a decision by a broader number of judges in the court of appeal, and then to the Supreme Court. That takes years. But Trump and Bondi and Rubio and Steve Miller seem to have the Chief Justice on speed dial. And they
they claim an emergency, because if they can't deport these people when they, you know, when they're ready to, somehow an injustice will be perpetrated by the fact that these people are prevented from being deported by the government.
That is certainly the claim. It is a manufactured emergency. And that's, to my mind, one of the more disturbing things about this, because to the extent to which the phrase emergency is used to excuse wholesale violations of a century-old constitutional principle, everybody's in jeopardy. If there's enough of an emergency, habeas corpus goes out the window. You know, so we may wind up in adjoining camps. You know, the false claim of emergency mirrors, ironically enough, what Israel has been doing for years, which is to claim that any criticism of it is terrorism. And any active resistance is terrorism. It's the same thing. You claim that you have to move immediately, and if people's rights are harmed in the process, that's just too bad.
Final question, Mr. Kleiman. Is there anything else, first off, you'd like to say about the current situation? And do you see any hope in combating the worst excesses, propaganda, and grotesque cruelty of this current government around First Amendment protests, as well as immigration and labor rights, of those being targeted, summarily arrested, and deported, even to countries willing to take those ICE and DHS designates for removal? Is there any hope that you see?
There is hope, and it's not because these courts are going to turn things around, but it is because people are going to turn things around. I've had a number of conversations with friends of my vintage in Central and South America who have been speaking derisively about us and laughing sometimes. Well, we had full-on military dictatorships. They were taking us out in helicopters and dropping us in the ocean. And what are you complaining about? We've gotten our democracies back. What the heck is wrong with you? And by and large, they have. At tremendous costs, things are going to be broken. People are going to be killed and tortured and imprisoned. And it's not going to be a pretty period by a long shot. But yeah, we are going to get some semblance of democracy and freedom back. The history of this sort of thing is that the Trumps and Bezoses and Musks of the world inevitably overreach. Part of it is arrogance, part of it is greed, part of it is just their inability to believe that, you know, communities of color and people who are less organized can successfully stand up and resist. And there's a long history of them being proven wrong. Not immediately, not next week, but proven wrong. So we're going to get there. It's certainly going to take a while. As one of my friends is fond of reminding me, people used to believe in the divine right of kings. Who the heck remembers that as a doctrine anymore? The idea of an actually sovereign monarch is now treated as, that's a museum piece. So yeah, we will get there. It's just going to take longer than any of us would like or hope for, but we will get there. In the meantime, we've got a wonderful community to be able to work with, and we all have a duty to have each other's backs.
How can listeners find out more about you and your work, Mr. Kleiman?
Well, right now, the easiest thing to do would be to, there's a collective of us who are doing a bunch of the cases involving the police shootings in Los Angeles, where demonstrators opposing and resisting ICE have been shot by the LAPD, shot by ICE, shot by the National Guard. You can find us via email at chingalamigra.la. That's chingalamigra.la at gmail.com. And the same reprobate band of lawyers who are defending the student activists around Palestine and defending the faculty at these universities, we're also defending all those beautiful people who are out in the streets trying to make sure ICE got the warm welcome it deserves.
That was defense attorney Mark Kleiman speaking to Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke about civil liberties and the defense of student protesters and migrant workers and families targeted for U.S. government repression. Part one of this interview aired on our July 14th show. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Marcy Winograd, Steve Zeltzer, and Thomas O'Rourke. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.